I was going to use full screen, but I never do that because I like to keep this list up here so you can see how many slides are remaining in the talk.
Well, there's 26 remaining by my count.
Right. This talk has three parts to it. You can see part one starts here. On scalar models, that's almost two-thirds of the slides. And then to go to part two, where we go from the scalar equation to system, very similar to Paul Breslov's. And the very last slide is part three. Part three, I'm going to go back to the experiment of Professor Wu. He's let me see one of his movies that you haven't seen yet. I'm going to show you the movie he sent to me. It was just wonderful. So the equation we're analyzing is a Wilson-Cowan type equation. This family of equations derived in the early 70s. And ours is in two space dimensions. And the x and the y, I'm assuming, sit in a flat sheet. We have a flat neural sheet. Presumably, like the tangential slice that Professor Wu described. We're not having our x and y be vertical. It's this way. T is time, and the U stands for the activity level, or as Bard calls it, the voltage at this position in time t. And everybody's seen these all week. W is the coupling. F is the firing rate. And TH we call the threshold. Everybody has a different letter for it. TH is threshold for us. And we're going to assume our W's at least are of this form. I'm going to mention the W soon. Some comments about them. That makes translation invariance hold. The what? Part two. We have to discuss part one first. Our goal was to analyze the simplest possible model for patterns, how they could form in the simplest possible equation in two dimensions. Our first goal was. So here's our firing rate, the one that we used. Usually they're sigmoidal functions. And we cook this one up. It's kind of sigmoidal. Our function is zero if u is below threshold, so there's no firing. It's pure. This is ideal situation. And if u is above threshold, f is positive, and it saturates out. For this example, th is 1.5. And that funny term in there with the exponential hooks things in here, so everything is C infinity. So we could do some theorems. I know this is probably the first time theorem is said. I don't have theorem up here, but we have some theorems. And this rho controls the steepness. If rho goes to zero, you get heavy side function. And Q is just the height of the thing. It doesn't have to be two.
Everything's differentiable still at the arc?
Yep, right here. Everything's differentiable at this point because of that term. That's why we put the term in there, so we could do theorems where we could do them.
The reason I introduced the sigmoid was because noise fluctuations always tend to smooth out.
Yes.
Close to the threshold. So
we put this in here because they were developing a differential equation using Fourier transform, and we found a little difficulty showed up. So we decided, well, let's make the thing zero for sure. So our Fourier transform development worked perfectly. So there weren't any flaws with theory. Okay, the next is the couplings. The only couplings we're going to see today are couplings like this. The R is the square root of x squared plus y squared, radial variable. Carlo and I have found for the integral equation multi-bumps for these three different kind of couplings I'm going to show on this slide in a minute. In the future, we're going to add the type of terms Paul Breslov would like to have added on to the W, the inhomogeneous terms. In fact, the future is tomorrow in one space dimension, because John Rubin's going to talk about a problem we did in 1D about the thalamus. He's going to have a different type of coupling. It will be negative and positive in places, and he's going to give a justification on physical grounds for his coupling. And also, we're going to add in the second part that we did in our paper the type of inhomogeneous couplings Paul's been added in one of his papers. I think it was a Physica D paper. Just to see the type of solution, how it would pin. And we found the important solution in that problem was a bump solution. It's very interesting. I'll leave all the details to John. Oh, there's a paper I wanted to mention also. I don't think it's been mentioned. That's one of the Pinto-Ehrmantraut papers. They did a very slick argument in which they started with two populations, excitable, inhibitory. They had three convolution integrals in their model, and each integral had a positive W, not one of these. But they had a singular perturbation problem or set up in which they could reduce from two equations to one, and all the W's combined into a combination, and this is what the ultimate W looked like when they did this. It was very slick. So they justified the type of problem that Amari has studied, where he would just start out with Mexican hat. Okay, I want to move on to show with this overhead. Could you just shut that off a second? The types of bumps Mark Carlo and I found for these three couplings. There's the three. We found multi-bump solutions would form. We put initial conditions in, like square impulses, and we found a two-bump for the first one. The second one that had three zeros, we found this kind of two-bump. This was one that had polynomial terms in. The numerics did not like polynomials. I found out the hard way what numerics like. The third one with lots of zeros, we found this three-bump. And for other parameter values, this multi-bump filled the whole sheet up with bumps. This, I hope, will show up again this morning soon, this three-bump in our model. Okay, thanks.
This bump stayed stationary or moving?
You shut a second. These bumps were for just the single equation before we have system. I'm going to say what happens when you have system to these bumps. But just for single equation, that's just the first approximation. You shouldn't just have single equation, but it took us a year to study the single equation just with the simplest couplings. And these bumps were all stable, didn't move or anything, just for the single equation. But you have to have the recovery variable attached, which is part two. This will show up again in part two. Something's wrong here. Okay, there's our equation, and now you can see the R up there, that square root. We have a specific form for the W, and when you go to analyze one of these things, they're very difficult to analyze the integral equation, to do any mathematics with it. If you have the pure symmetric situation in which you change to just radial coordinates and ignore the theta version, sometimes you can analyze that. But we first studied all these one-dimensional problems, and I emailed Amari and asked him what's been done in 2D. This was 2 years ago. He wrote back that there were two or three papers in two dimensions. They were all axisymmetric solutions, and they were very nice papers, but they weren't satisfactory. He said, try to find multi-bumps in 2D, which is what did multi-bumps in 2D, whether they exist in the real animal or not. We started looking for those. So back to this, we did multi-bumps in 2D are not axisymmetric solutions. So we needed to somehow analyze this. We decided the best way was to transform it into PDE, because you can use PDE methods. So you use the Fourier transform in two dimensions, and this is the version we applied. Here's the two variables, alpha and beta will be the two variables you end up with. And you apply this Fourier transform to this equation, and because I've used this very simple form of W, the convolution theorem applies, if you know what that is, the math people. And the Fourier transform of both sides, you get this product. This is the key right here. To get a PDE, we want the Fourier transform of our W to be very nice so you can get PDE out of it. They're not always so nice. In fact, I'm going to show one on with overhead. But what we did find out, for all the W's we're considering, these simple W's, if they're just functions of the single variable, then the Fourier transform is a function of the square root of alpha squared plus beta squared. That's good. So our assumption was, since the F hat of W is so ugly, usually, I'm going to show one soon, to obtain the PDE, we approximated the F hat of W for those W's by a nice rational function. Turned out to work nicely, and we got a PDE out of it. But I'd like to put up a slide about the Fourier transform of one of these and show how ugly it gets. Here's one. This will lead to the very first picture. The goes down below and has 1, 0 like the Mexican hat, 2D version. The Fourier transform of that is exactly this. This is a theorem. And because of these three halves, it's very, and this is too ugly to get a PDE out of. These three halves kill you. So what we did, I had to call eta my square root because to fit everything on the slide. We approximated this by one of our rational functions. And we found with these numbers, found by the program fminsearch in MATLAB, that we got a pretty good approximation to this one. And then we used the inverse transform. This is the formula for it. And we compared this W, this new W, with the old W. See how they looked? And that's the next slide.
Better than doing the Taylor expansion of the convolution and using the first three moments you get out of that to approximate
No, we didn't try that.
I mean, I did that anyway.
Well, we did this so that we'd get a nice PDE. These terms are going to lead to nice PDE.
If you just take the first three moments of the Taylor expansion.
Well, we'd have to try it and compare. So how good is this? Was our number, or were our numbers there? Shut that off again. Here's the original W. Here's our approximation. The only error really was in this little region right here. Otherwise, it was right on. It seemed pretty good.
Since it's just a phenomenological model anyway, it's fine to have something.
All right. So we wanted to show how good our approximation worked. Okay, I won't be using this anymore. So you approximate this and put it in here, and I'm going to show how to get a PDE out of it. So there's an example of a nice fourth order guy. Multiply both sides of, we put this in for F hat, multiply both sides of our equation by this. And there's some identities to use. This term times this, we use this identity. You get this nice fourth order derivative inside F hat. And then there's the alpha squared plus beta squared times this. We use this type of identity. So you apply these identities and put them all under one F hat. F hat of the inside of one side is F hat of the inside of the other side. Equate the interiors. There's the PDE. We only did this because we were desperate to analyze our problem and get something to happen that wasn't symmetric.
So just on a historical point, Bill?
Yeah.
The first person to do this with neural equations and turn the integral stuff into PDEs was a man called John Griffith in a paper in 1966 in England.
I didn't know the history of it. I didn't know the history of who's done what. We just. Okay. So there's our PDE. This is an X, Y, and T coordinates. These will be X and Y partial derivatives. And I'm never going to show this PDE again. What we're going to do is change it into radial polar coordinates, R and theta. I'm never going to show that PDE either. You write that PDE out, it takes half the page. So I'm just going to refer to this R theta T PDE as the full PDE. That's all I'm going to refer to it as. Just remember, the full PDE is this one in radial and theta coordinates. There's a sequence of PDEs coming. There's not too many, though. So now we did Marty's approach, and we looked for symmetric solution, actually symmetric solution. That was our idea. And we want to linearize our PDE around it, see if it's unstable. If it's unstable, you put it into the PDE plus a perturbation. It should evolve into some interesting structure. You mentioned this yesterday. So here's the details of how to carry that out. First, here's our PDE if you ignore theta. This is called the radial PDE. It's still nonlinear. To get the symmetric solutions that we're interested in, those will be time-independent solutions. Ignore time, and this PDE becomes this ODE. And then we want initial conditions near zero because of the 1 over r terms. You need these two initial conditions. It's mathematics theorem. And we want at infinity our solution to go back to zero. So this is an ODE problem. It's fourth order. It's very tricky to analyze. We don't have any proofs yet, even for the fourth order ODE. What we did to find a solution of this thing is to go to the full PDE, radial PDE, time dependent, and put in initial condition like a Gaussian. And the solution evolved right away as time went to infinity to a nice time independent radial solution. I'm going to show a whole example of all this. This is called the radial PDE. It finds our ODE solutions. Then what you do is take your ODE solution, linearize the PDE around it, and see what it predicts. It's an easy. This has all been done. I saw it done for a Schrodinger's problem 10 years ago, where they ended up finding nice multi-bump solutions to interfere with their wave. It's also been done recently, the same game, by Tasso Kopper studying the Gray-Scott equation. Beautiful result. He gets these bumps just like we're going to. So here is the final ugly math slide. U tilde of r is our ODE solution. If you want to linearize around it, you add on that perturbation. Standard thing to do. Multiply by, separate variables and assume it's a function of r and t times the cosine of m theta. It's a standard thing to do. You substitute it into the full PDE. And then you keep the first order, the mu is small, you keep the first order term in nu, and out comes this linear PDE. We've linearized our equation right around here. It's a linear PDE. This guy drives everything we've done. So now we want to know what happens to our solution. Is it stable or not? So you want to know how to use this problem. You go put in initial condition to this problem, and we expect on applied physics reasoning. The solution of this problem ought to evolve into eigenfunction times e to lambda t. Lambda will be the biggest number for which you get such an eigenfunction. Picks it right out every time. It's unbelievable how good it was at picking out the biggest lambda. So you put in an m, little m. By the way, where did all the cosine of m theta terms go? When you linearize, every single term has one. So you cancel it. The little m is here. So then you start your search with MATLAB for each m. You start with 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. For each m, you do this. and you find the biggest lambda for which there's an eigenfunction. And you graph lambda against the m, and you want to find the m for which the lambda is biggest. This is going to be the m that's selected by the problem. And so it'll be this term times cos m theta. And if you multiply, so example, if m is 3, if m is 3 gives you the biggest lambda, cos 3 theta times this guy, this eigenfunction. If you graph that thing, just graph cos 3 theta times eigenfunction, and in three dimensions, you'll see a three-bump structure form. The prediction is, because that's the m with the biggest lambda, this guy will take over and drive your solution towards a three-bump.
Critical it is to retain the biharmonic term in the PDEs that you look at?
No.
Because a lot of these results you get with diffusion logic.
No, we haven't done that. We've just done this one case. Took us a full year to do this one case. I'm willing to try anything in the future, which I'm going to do. In fact,
is your three bump solution stable? Yeah, if you're getting anywhere.
I'm going to, yes.
Yeah. So for a single equation, you wouldn't expect to get that in the reality. And the first applications are always
that. Okay, I'm going to carry it all now for an example. I hope the non-math people forgive me for all this math. So here's our example. Those are my numbers. By the way, if I let the m be 0 or negative, my resulting W of R will be positive. It won't have any negative part to it at all. But RM is 1. For those numbers are going to be the rest of the day, my numbers. And if you take this guy and find the inverse Fourier transform, out comes one of my W's. There's technical reasons why this nice example, mostly numerical, it's the easiest to compute with than the other one I had up there. So I'll just do my examples for this one. So first of all, we went to the radial PDE solver, put an initial condition, it found a solution. That dashed line is threshold. You can see there's one region above threshold. This is a hair above it, so it's really a one-bump radial solution. Our radial PDE solver also found this one. It didn't find this one. So this one is here on this diagram of threshold against U max. To get this diagram, I took this one, sent it to Otto. Otto found this whole thing, all the whole bifurcation curve it was. Found all of them. It finds the stable ones. This one finds everybody. P1 is this solution. And this curve with these pluses means that the radial PDE could also find those. They're all stable as solutions of the radial PDE. This guy is my P3 solution. He's got two big bumps and a little tiny one here. This guy also sits on a curve with pluses because the radial PDE could find him. He's stable. This guy's unstable. He's this guy. But Otto found him. It was very interesting to put this into one of our experiments. I did not bring it with me, but what I'm going to do is now continue on with this one and show how they lead to multi-bumps in 3D. First will be this, then this. By the way, it's important to notice these are below zero. If I were to rotate these around the axis, which I'm going to do, you'll see an empty spot in the middle, look like rings. And the next set of experiments, we're going to have this above zero, so we'll have a peak in the middle, which is like Paul's 2D. He had a peak in the middle yesterday. So first, it turns out a three-bump solution does show up. This is our P1 solution. We linearized around it and made our linear PDE do all the work. For each m, we found the biggest lambda for which that equation had an eigenfunction solution. For each m, this is the lambda against m. Which m is selected? The m with the biggest lambda. That's the global one that's going to be selected. So the prediction is when m is 3, cosine of 3 theta, here's my eigenfunction, times that eigenfunction, you'd find a 3-bump structure. I should have drawn one of these with MATLAB. It's interesting that this eigenfunction sits right above this guy. I'll show that on the next picture. Ah, good. There's the solution. If you rotate my solution around the axis, you get this symmetric guy. The eigenfunction sits right above that bump. That's right above this ring. And this prediction, when m is 3, you have a positive biggest lambda, that's going to destabilize my ODE solution. And it ought to break up into the cos 3 theta times eigenfunction structure. Hopefully it will. I'm going to show the movie. What we do is put this into the full PDE plus a random perturbation. We use 10,000 space points. We use the MATLAB random jump number generator. They're all 10 to the minus 4 in size. We did not try to influence what he would turn into. So here it is, evolving with time. It did it. Changed into a 3-bump. It just plays over again. It obeyed the linearization, and this is how we found a 3-bump solution form. What I want to say next is, you're only seeing this out to time 35. You can see here, these almost want to form. If I had just let this program go, more bumps would have formed. We learned how to kill those bumps by what, when these raised were formed by time 35, and these hadn't formed yet, these outer guys, I raised my threshold 0.05. It's 0.25, I raised it to 0.3. It prevented those, inhibited them from forming. This is the kind of thing with that electric field I was thinking you could control. The threshold level. So this just shows time 35. This is when we turned the threshold up in our program. Didn't let any of those form. And when we did that, we let this thing run for 500 time steps. I let it run all day. That's all it sat there. So it looked pretty stable. That was my detection of it stable. Yeah, that cos 3 theta times the eigenfunction that was selected by the linearization, that's what broke it. Okay, this next one is the pre-3 solution, which was much higher. There it is here with the 2 bumps. And you linearize around that thing, and at each m, you go make that linearization do its thing, find the eigenfunction and the biggest lambda. You can see when m is 9, the biggest lambda occurs, and the eigenfunction sits right above the outer ring. That means the outer ring ought to break into 9. This shows no predictions about the inner ring. We were baffled about what happened to the inner ring. I played the movie over and over, and suddenly I could see what happened to it when I played it step by step. After the 9 bumps form, if you just watch for it, the inner ring breaks away, shrinks down, and becomes the previous solution I showed, which ought to break into 3. I did all the numerics and did all the comparisons. It just shrunk right onto it.
How long did this take you to do that?
A while. It took forever. We wanted to get it right. You know, it might have taken 2 weeks to get this just perfect. Okay, I'm going to show this movie. Put this in as initial condition to the full PDE solver, plus random perturbation, don't try to influence, and see if the 9s show up. I'm going to show it from 2 sides. Here's the side view, then I'll show it from above.
Did you have to do any special numerics to get all this to do?
Yeah, I had to study numerics for a long time and practice my numerics and get the feel for the numerics, how they all work. So, first it breaks up, watch the guy break away. And then he breaks into 3. So in our paper, which is coming in Marty's journal about these bumps, and all the movies are there, we did some analysis about the breakup into 3. No theorems, but applied math analysis, yes.
In that case, do you have to raise the threshold again?
I raised the threshold again.
Yeah. Control it that way.
0.05, and then it just stuck around for hours. Now, when I get to part two, I'm not going to have to raise my threshold. I just discovered that the other day. And if you don't have to raise that threshold at all, it's unbelievable. In fact, if I raise the threshold, I kill anything interesting happening with the recovery variable. The interesting thing is they all line up now. They all rearrange into a nice pattern.
Yeah, with just threefold symmetry.
Yeah. See these guys move in. Sorry. Okay, I'm going to show this from above now. Oh, I'm not quite going to show it from above. I wanted to show it time 25. It hadn't broken away yet. It breaks away just after this and shrinks down. Time 50 it forms. Then I raised my threshold 0.05, let it run for 500 time steps, just stuck around. You can see why it took a year to do this. Okay, this is from above. You look at those 12 peaks. I'm going to start the whole movie over and you'll see the rings and the breakup. I wanted to do this because in the second part we have target patterns show up. We're going to show from above. You got to get the hand right on it. I slowed it down. I can see they're all rearranged in this nice packing formation. These guys want to form, but they can't because I made that threshold too high on them. You can see there's nothing in the middle. The next experiment will show something in the middle. So these were annular rings that broke into formations. Now this 7-bump solution. We let our radial PDE go back to work, put in a new type of initial condition. It found this one, this ODE solution, which has a peak in the middle here, plus a bump and a tiny little thing. So we linearized around this thing. For each M, we did this until we found the M with the biggest lambda, cosine 6 theta. Here's our times our eigenfunction, ought to influence this guy to break into 6 peaks. By the way, where is he? He's up at Q1. Here is a different point that Marty was talking about yesterday. On this lower branch, he took a solution represented by this point and did M against lambda. The whole function would be below zero. Stable, completely stable. This is a solution of the full PDE. At this point, the function would just come up and touch once. And just past that point, it would go above. So that's like this kind of bifurcation. The other, it's a hard bifurcation you mentioned. Is that what you call it? Oh, okay. I want to mention just before going to part two about the upper branches of the two curves only for a second, but that's after I show what happens with this guy. Here he is, rotated around the axis, and we can see the linearization says because the eigenfunction sits above this ring, it ought to break into 6. If you watch the movie, this guy's going to break away after the 6 also, and like the other one, and shrink down to the 1-bump solution that he ought to break into. And here it is. I put a lot of frames here so you could see it in slow motion. What shocked me is it kept working all the time. It almost never failed. We let the M increase from 0 up to about 20 until we found the M that gave us the biggest lambda, and then we used that perturbation. That was the prediction. For this solution, we just put the solution in plus random perturbation.
But how many different
I tried 3 or 4 times, different random perturbations. You always got it to do the same thing. Kept repeating itself, formed this nice 6-7 bump solution.
Can you change the parameters so that the 5 and the 6 would have same size lambda?
Yeah, you can. I didn't do that. I can also change the parameter so we wouldn't get a 3 bump, we'd get a 2. Right. I stayed away from that so that I would pick out the 6 on every try. I knew that if we had the same probability, the same height with the 5 or the 6, it could go either way. But for this journal article, we stuck with this one. This is in the paper in Marty's journal. Will be. The Dynamical Systems Journal that lets you play movies. Okay. This guy broke into these bumps because he was unstable. Both, I had 2 bifurcation diagrams. There's a branch that was out of sight. And on that branch, way high up, we had these multi-ring solutions which were stable completely as solutions of the full PDE. And if you rotate those things around the axis, they just sat there. Perturbed those, they didn't go anywhere. I call those stable station or target patterns, stationary target patterns. They weren't doing anything. I don't even know, I don't think we even mentioned those in that paper. I was afraid to mention them. I thought there's something wrong with them. Because they never did anything. They were just stationary target patterns. It turns out they play a role in part 2, which is going to start right away. Almost right away, here's our solution at these times. This is when I raised my threshold.
Can I ask a question? Someone unfamiliar with this. These are alleged to be solutions to the original integral differential equation.
Hopefully. We did not check that. Our only check was the first thing I showed, the first slide. The slide I showed here with the multi-bumps were solutions of the integral differential, integral PDE, or integral equation. No, the integral equation itself for that slide with those multi-bumps that I showed on the overhead.
Okay. And if I could ask another question. What prevents you from doing the direct numerical? This is actually quite numerical. You know, in the course of this, you do quite a lot of numerics. What prevents you from doing numerics directly on the integral equation?
It all depends. Let me discuss the numerics for the PDE. Because the PDE is of the form it is, we use finite differences, and those fourth order and second order terms produce sparse matrices. You change the whole thing into a matrix problem. And when you use the MATLAB sparse matrix routines, it shortens the time dramatically. This run took an hour. Actually, this took 52 minutes, this run, before it would be complete out to this time step. We did do numerics on the full integral equation. Then you don't get sparse matrices. You get these monstrous matrices. And it might have taken 4 hours. It was a lot more computing time because you're doing real integration. You don't leave out anything. There's no sparse matrices involved. It took forever.
Not 4 years.
I mean, no. It's doable.
In 1971, when Wilson and I were doing these calculations, we had only a PDP with the calculations on it. It used to take us 2 weeks to do a one-dimensional problem with the integral equation.
I'm going to show a one-dimensional integral equation solution, which I did just last week. I'm going to show a movie of it. That didn't take as much time. You can just solve the one-dimensional integral equations, no sweat. You go to 2D, it just takes so much time. And because the analytical techniques were available for PDE, maybe we were too lazy to go check the integral equation. Yes?
How many grid points?
10,000. Yeah. Actually, it was 9,700. If I used 9,800, MATLAB kicked me off. Well, I went right to the limit of what MATLAB would let me do. So we'd get the best accuracy for the pictures of the bump. Because that's the only one I know. Okay, now to the system, like Paul had yesterday, if we call A the adaptation variable, I like to call it recovery be a variable, because this looks just like Fitzhugh-Nagumo recovery variable equation. We put RA in the firing rate.
Why did you do that?
according to my experts, this reason right here, because when the thing wants to slow down, the firing rate wants to slow down. Carson and...
That's a little bit of it.
Well, I agree. I went along with Carson and Carlo and...
It's really not quite...
Well, that depends whether that's an acre or...
I knew I'd get in trouble if I put this down because I don't know neuroscience.
It's not quite right, but it's a...
It's good enough?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So let's have RA inside our firing rate, and we can add on I, like Paul would want to. I'm not going to add on I today. I'm anxious to add on I and also fix this up, if he'd like us to see what happens to what I'm going to show. So with this version of system, I want to see what happens to the solutions we found in the previous section. And also we investigated rotating waves. You have to remember we're assuming our x and y are on a sheet like the tangential slice. This thing, this parameter controls everything. If you notice, if C is 0, then this A and this A could be 0. In which case, if you put it up here, A identically 0 when C is 0, you get our equation. And our I will be 0 the rest of today. First thing we did was go see what happened to my stationary target patterns that weren't moving. So here's our system of integral equations, and we used the PDE approach again on them. And we got this PDE system, just like the last time. Nice PDE system, and of course you want to look for symmetric solutions again. So, did the same approach, find time-independent, axially symmetric solutions. Hopefully they're going to go unstable and give us something. Now you ignore time, and the partial of A with respect to T is 0, so you put that here, and you get A equals CU. You put that here, and you will get just a single ODE out of it again with these boundary conditions. And here's the same L as before, our big ODE operator. So you start with C equals 0, A equals 0, and one of our ODE solutions. In particular, my ODE led to the 3 bump. Or start when C is 0, A is 0, or the stationary pattern I had. That's what I'm going to start with. And then you raise the C and use auto to continue the thing and see what happens is. And we found there was a critical value of C at which something would happen. So here is my stationary solution on one of those high branches. This is on the 7 bump. There's something in the middle here. It's a big peak in the middle. And there's our PDE. So you continue the thing and find the thing with a function of C. And when C was about 0.5, things got interesting. So you put in that solution plus random perturbation, see what happens to it. You have to remember there's a tau. This tau, if it's small, it wants oscillations to happen. You're going to see the thing start to oscillate, but then it's going to decide what to do. No, this one will not oscillate. This one will just kick. It's the next one. This one will just spit out rings like Paul's yesterday. So the target pattern starts to spit rings out. We're looking at it from above. So it just spits out these rings. What happens in the middle is you get a big peak in the middle, then shrinks, then a big peak. And as it shrinks, it spits out a ring. I'm going to show this from the side so you can see the big peak. That's this one. So it starts out high on my bifurcation diagram. Now it goes up high like Paul's did, comes down low. And as it comes down, it spits out a ring. And it goes up and down, it spits out a ring. The difference between ours and his is we don't have, probably because of the coupling, we don't have a pacemaker center. We don't have any eye doing it. So this is the thing from the side. Paul's went up and down. just for fun, I programmed his last week. And let me just push this way over here. I have a directory called Breslov. And here's his solution. We could just look at it. It goes up high and then goes down below. Watch the peak when it comes down low, and as it spits out this extra guy.
That's essentially what Hugh Wilson and I.
All right, see how it spit it out from the right here? Ours kind of does the same thing.
That's basically something like that's in our 1973 paper.
So this is out of their new paper, and I picked a number that looked like give me the biggest. I was happy to be able to program. This is my programming of the integral equation. This is a solution of the integral equation, his integral equation. So we were able to solve integral equation pretty easily. I needed about 4,000 points to make this real nice, and we have a shorter time step. That's why you're seeing slower than here.
Is it the 2D?
Finally, we looked at rotating ways because we're interested in Professor Wu's experiments. So here's a rigid rotating wave definition. You're a function. U and theta are functions of R, and this new variable phi, which combines the theta and the time. So here's our PDE. This is a standard thing to do. There's a nice paper by Barclay that describes all of this. Here's our PDE. It becomes this. The time is gone. If you find a solution to this thing, it's called a rigid rotating wave. So what I did is then get on the internet and google.com, and I looked for all these spiral wave papers and came up with this very interesting paper by Golubitsky, Knobloch, and Stewart. They were studying reaction diffusion equations, and in particular how spirals could show up in these equations. And if I can remember it right, you linearized around a constant solution. Then the linearization, they looked for a form which would encourage spiral. And they looked for combinations of Bessel functions. And Bessel functions, if the argument is real, will not be spirals. They put in complex argument and then took the real part of the whole thing. And they found these nice forms, beautiful forms for spirals.
A bit of a contortion.
Well, they were, no, it wasn't. I thought it was beautiful. They looked at the level curves of their solutions and then gave an argument why you put these things in and perturb them. The full nonlinear equation ought to pick up on them and turn into a spiral. I tried all that and our problem wouldn't work. Mainly because of this F. Once you get below threshold, see, U equals zero is our constant solution. Once you get below threshold, we're in trouble. And linearize around it and give a small perturbation, you're still below threshold, the integral equation will force the solution to go back to zero. Ours are bigger. So I gave up on that and tried just to look for a rotating wave solution. Couldn't find one. So I tried to find any set of parameters where I could find a rotating wave function. So I went, let W be minus 1, let C equal 0, in which case you could let A equal 0, and the whole thing reduced to this. And I let my F be Heaviside. Absolute limiting case, out came this function. I'm substituted in, it works. I'm going to draw it next. If you just draw R against phi and graph the thing, you'll see a still picture, which is next. That's this. And if you put phi equal theta minus omega t with omega equal minus 1, this thing should rotate if you graph it that way. And I'm going to graph that and then raise the c and see how this changes. So it rotates. This is just by putting phi equal theta minus omega t and graph it with MATLAB, and it rotates nicely. Outside we have u is 0, inside u is above threshold here, on the border it's threshold, and it's a discontinuous function because of the Heaviside function. what is the best we could do? I found out through a literature search there haven't been too many closed-form solutions that were spiral, so we were happy with this discontinuous spiral wave. But the interesting thing is to raise the C and see if you get any that kind of look like this. We did that, and that's this one. Raise C to about 0.2. You go solve the problem, and here it is. This is Carlos. Not exactly a rigid rotating wave, but it's, you get the message, this baby's rotating, periodic, it comes around and around. Now it's starting to look like what you're going to see in the last slide, the movie Professor Wu sent me. It starts to have characteristics of spiral. Yeah.
Question. Is this infinite size or just edges?
This is just
with the edges.
0 to 10 that we solved it on, right. This is infinity for us. 10, not too big, right. Yeah. I can't tell you because we have so many slides or frames in here to slow it down for the MPEG player. I can't tell you.
The question is really, is it periodic or not?
The only thing I can tell you is that it looks periodic every time.
Once.
All right. When we write this paper, we're going to put that graph in and put to indicate it. Right. Right. And here's our center. You can see that our center there. Okay, now I'm going to get to the final part. What happened to my 3-bump and 7-bump solution? This is the second last slide. Okay, here's our 3-bump solution that formed. So you go at C equals 0 and take my ODE solution. It's just a ring. Raise the C and perturb it, see what happens to the thing. So you see a ring at first, and we'll see what it evolves into for our system. What happens is that the C isn't very big. These form and sit. Nothing happens. You've got to raise that C high enough. And then it passes a critical value at which these things can't decide if they want to be breathers or rotators. It's that tau. They want to be breathers. They start going up and down, but then the rotation just overwhelms it. First it wants to form, see if then it starts to rotate. This is very slow in MATLAB. When I play this MPEG player, it just happens so fast. We didn't, once RTH was 0.25, we did not have to raise it to make those stick around. Once they started rotating, they were not, these outer guys were not able to form new bumps. We didn't have to raise RTH. It was, this rotation just wouldn't let them happen. So you could see the first one oscillate. Now, if I let the tau be very small, they would just oscillate up and down forever. No rotation. Just be like breathers. So there's a game between tau and C. I know we have to figure this out in all the curves. Finally, here's the one with the peak in the middle, the 7-bump. We're going to start the experiment all over again. You'll just see a single bump this time. And then it will form our 7-bump real fast, and our C is up in there above the critical value. It wants to see, it wanted to be a breather too. Bump up and down a little bit, and then rotation. The reason I did this is because of the last slide. Professor Wu sent me his movie. And I looked at it over and over and over again. It had characteristics of rotating spiral, but it also seemed to have a characteristic of one of these things. So I wanted to see if our model had both types of solutions, bumps that rotate and rotating spiral-like solutions, so that we could see if we agree with his results. Finally, the last slide, you saw this earlier, except you didn't see this one. Maybe it's, he put this in, I just put this.
Yeah, we saw.
Okay. And there's his slice, the tangential slice. And he got his rotating wave to work. I'm just going to show you the movie he sent me. He didn't show you this. He let me show this one. There it is. After watching this thing, I kept thinking the yellow is the high point. I thought, this has the characteristics of a bump rotating. It also has the characteristic of rotating wave. So I went and found those rotating bumps so I could show that we have both characteristics in our model. And they more or less agree kind of with his. He has a, it seemed like a single bump to me. David Pinto sent me an email several months ago. He's a neuroscientist saying, I'd really like to see if a bump could persist. This is one way in which a bump might be able to persist.
And this is not a repeating.
Is that?
This isn't a cycling example. Not, this is a continuous.
Right. This has 36 turns to 33 turns to it, this one. So you call this a stable phenomenon, right? You can address all questions to him about this. We hope it's a stable phenomenon. And I hope the math contributed towards how it all fits together. I'll take any advice about doing anything, especially from the experimentalists, but math guys also. We're ready to move on into the future with our model and look at more complicated models now that we know how to do some computing. And that's the end of the story so far.